Things were just starting to go well for her after years of drug abuse and having her children taken away from her. But a pit bull puppy and a plea for help changed all of that one snowy night. Was she just exercising her right to defend herself? This is the story of Brittany Smith, the woman who stood her ground against her attacker. Hi friends, I'm Katie, and this is Katie Does Crime. Thank you for joining me for the first time if you're new here, and hello to the usual rapscallions and reprobates. Please consider subscribing or joining me on Patreon if you'd like to hear more true crime stories. 32-year-old Brittany Joyce Smith was a mother of four, but her kids had been taken from her in July 2016 due to a meth problem that had consumed her after her grandmother and her baby died in the span of 1 year. Things were looking up for her a little bit, though. She was clean now after completing a rehab program, and she'd just been hired at a flooring company during the interview. She was about to start making enough money to cover the rent on her four-bedroom house with no problem. Brittany and her husband, Christopher, had separated in December 2017 after a long on-again, off-again relationship, so she lived alone in the red brick house in Stevenson, Alabama. Maybe to help with loneliness, she contacted 38-year-old breeder Joshua Todd Smith about buying a pit bull puppy after seeing his post on Facebook. Despite the shared last name, they weren't related, and in fact, Brittany said they had only really met once through mutual friends when she was a teenager. She remembers hearing that Todd was violent years back, but hey, he had puppies now. Brittany bought a puppy named Athena from Todd on January 14th, 2018, and the next day he called her and asked for a ride from South Pittsburgh, Tennessee. It was just about a 15-minute drive from her house over the Alabama border into Lower Tennessee. She didn't have a car, but asked her brother if he could take her because it was a snowy night and Todd said he was stuck in a park with no one else to call. She said it was a one-night-only sort of deal because she felt bad for him. He had a beer when they picked him up, but he didn't seem drunk, and Brittany says she didn't know he was on drugs at the time. But after her brother dropped them off at her house and they were giving the puppy a bath, it came out that he had a drug problem but wanted to clean up his act and work on getting custody of his daughter. At this point, Brittany had already agreed to let him spend the night at her house, so she tried to relate to him, giving him advice about the way she was fighting addiction and trying to get her kids back. She said he needed to get his priorities straight. The next thing she knew, Todd was livid at the way she talked to him, thinking she was trying to act superior rather than help him. Brittany said he screamed obscenities at her, headbutted her, ran behind her to the bedroom, busted down the door, and tackled her. He said he'd kill her and strangled her until she passed out. When she woke up, she had been stripped and was lying in her own urine. Todd was on top of her, saying he'd kill her if she even breathed wrong. He pressed her head against the side of the bed so hard she thought her neck might break. She tried to scratch him on his face, his chest, his arm, frantically and desperately fighting him away until her false fingernails came off. They fought each other onto the floor, and Todd strangled her again. Brittany said she had to just lie there as he assaulted her sexually. And then when he was finished, he acted as if nothing had happened, like they were friends again. He just wanted a cigarette. Brittany called her mom for a ride to pick up some cigarettes, but her brother again came to give her and Todd a lift. Inside the gas station, she saw a police officer but said she was afraid to speak up because Todd had threatened her if she told anyone. Instead, she went to the cashier and told her to act normal, but to give her a piece of paper. Brittany scribbled down phone numbers for her mom and two friends and then wrote Todd's name and address. She said, "If I'm dead in the morning, this is who did it." She left with her cigarettes and had her brother drive them back home. As soon as Todd left the car, Brittany told her brother that the cashier wanted to talk to him back at the store. She said, "Go back and talk to Paige." Todd was in the kitchen when Brittany's brother returned just after 1 a.m. and came into the house through the kitchen door. Brittany said she didn't know anything was happening until a gun went off. She heard her brother say, "You tried to kill my sister. You need to get the out. Get your and get out." She ran into the kitchen where Todd was threatening to kill her brother, and then Brittany herself, and then himself too. Todd and the brother punched each other, moving around the room, hitting each other in the head. But to Brittany, it looked like her brother was taking the brunt. Todd was choking him, and she feared he couldn't breathe. So she picked up his .22 caliber revolver, the one she knew he always carried with him, which he'd laid on the counter. She yelled for Todd to let her brother go, and then she shot, and shot again. It seemed like nothing was happening, so she shot a third time, and that's when they fell to the floor together. She thought she'd killed her brother, but he got up, took the gun away from her, and said that he was okay, that they were okay. She called 911 while they gave Todd CPR together. The thing is, Brittany told the 911 operator that her brother had shot Todd. She said Todd was trying to kill her, and her brother tried to get him off of her. She said her brother was trying to protect her. The 911 operator asked specifically if Todd had assaulted her in a sexual way, and Brittany said no, but he was trying to when her brother found them. She made sure to tell the operator that her brother was licensed to carry. During the 911 call, Brittany kept saying things like, "Please come back to me," and "Todd, please come back, baby." And I'm like, "Baby?" It seems like she was trying to make it seem like she cared for him to make herself seem more innocent. Or is she just a nice person who didn't want to kill someone at the end of the day, even if he had been torturing her an hour before? And that wasn't the only thing that didn't quite line up about Brittany's story. She testified that she shot Todd, but in her police statement, she originally repeated the story that she told the 911 operator, that her brother had been the shooter. She testified that she was assaulted in her vagina, but also told others that she was sodomized. She testified that she told her brother to go back to the gas station to talk to the cashier, but in her police statement, she said she was texting friends during the car ride home from the gas station, and that if her brother knew anything, it was because a friend had told him. She testified that her brother went back to the gas station after dropping her and Todd off at her house, but in her police statement, she said that all three of them went inside the house together, and her brother just seemingly somehow knew to accuse Todd of assault. One day later, she felt too guilty and changed her story. She told the police investigator that her brother was in jail for something she did to protect herself. She said at first that she figured she only shot Todd once, but then she said, "Oh wait, she shot twice because the first attempt didn't make Todd lose his grip on the headlock he had her brother in." The police investigator asked her if Todd was on the ground when she shot him because that's what her brother said happened. And Brittany replied, "I was just trying to say to Chris, y'all, Todd, separate, separate. And I couldn't get them separated. So as soon as Chris, like, he didn't get, well, actually, yes, he did get Todd to the ground, but like Todd was still, you know, having, and I just took a shot." It sounds like an awful lot of word salad to me, but I guess that happens when you're trying to keep your story straight. She then admitted that she told her brother to wipe off the gun after the shooting. It's unclear where some of the discrepancies in her story come from, but her explanation for the major one, the one about her brother being the shooter, is that she and her brother both believe their town is backward and wouldn't fairly prosecute a woman for defending herself. The thing is that there was evidence of Brittany being physically assaulted, 30-plus injuries of evidence worth. There was bruising on her body, bite marks, a handprint around her neck. Tiny blood spots under the skin showed that she had been strangled, and she complained that it hurt to swallow. She really did have a missing fake nail, and the nail underneath was bleeding. Even the cashier at the gas station could tell that something had happened because of Brittany's bleeding nail and her inflamed neck. Brittany would later cry as her assault nurse showed pictures of her bruises, bites, and blood in court. The nurse called it an extensive amount of injuries. The problem is that there was no evidence of any assault of a sexual nature. There was no trauma around any of Brittany's genital area, no semen found there. Brittany declined an STI test, which I find a little interesting since she didn't even know Todd. At first, it felt to me like this could be a sign of Brittany admitting that nothing happened. However, the assault nurse said that in the majority of this kind of case, you're not going to find genital trauma nor DNA evidence. The forensic lab tested Brittany's sheets and found DNA from multiple men, but it wasn't a match for Todd. DNA on swabs from her body were less clear, but the forensic biologist said she couldn't rule out a match for Todd. The investigator who collected Brittany's linens said there were no evident wet stains, that he saw none of the urine Brittany claimed to have woken up in after blacking out. And even worse for Brittany's case, her brother didn't appear to have any injuries despite supposedly being wailed on by Todd, and he didn't mention any while he was under arrest. But it turns out that Todd had high amounts of methamphetamine in his system at the time of his autopsy, like very high. Xanax and alcohol too. A toxicologist testified that meth can cause a person to be aggressive and more likely to get in a fight. And Brittany didn't know at the time when she picked Todd up in Tennessee that his dad had kicked him out of the house after a violent fight that night. She also probably didn't know that Todd had been arrested almost 80 times previously, at least 6 for domestic violence. She also probably didn't know that his ex-wife claims that 2 weeks into their new marriage, he broke her nose. A cousin said that when Todd took Xanax, the neighbors would be on eggshells. To the judge in her case, it didn't seem like Brittany made any attempt to get away from Todd, this person she thought was so dangerous. Brittany told the cashier at the gas station that she was in trouble, but she didn't involve the officer who was there. She said she was worried Todd would see and somehow kill her brother out in the car. Brittany also didn't try to stay in the car with her brother when he brought her back home after the cigarette run. And when her mom texted her later in the evening, Brittany said in all caps, "Do not come over here. Please stop. I am fine." Was she protecting her mom? Was she too traumatized to know how to protect herself? 4 total gunshot wounds were later found on Todd. Brittany was indicted on murder charges in March 2018, but she asked to be given immunity under Alabama's Stand Your Ground law for self-defense. This law says that it's okay to defend yourself when unlawful force is imminent. But the judge in her case said no, there was no reason to believe Brittany needed to use deadly force.
In that rejection of her Stand Your Ground hearing, the judge in one of the, comments made that she could have run away. And I just think I find that remarkable that that would be something that would be applicable to a situation where most of us have never been in a situation like this. So the idea of running away is what you hear time and time again, generally directed at women, for example, that are in abusive relationships or children that have no opportunity to get away from parents who abuse them.
The local DA said that at her Stand Your Ground hearing, Brittany lacked credibility and seemed to have selective memory. The thing is that the nurse who examined Brittany said memory loss is actually common after a traumatic experience. And Brittany did have a breakdown while she was awaiting trial and was deemed incompetent to stand trial. She was diagnosed with PTSD and spent months at Bryce, an Alabama State mental health hospital. When she was well enough to be released, Brittany was facing life in prison. So a month before her trial in 2020, she pleaded guilty to murder. She said, "I'm really disappointed with having to take a plea deal. I'm not a murderer, but when it's the lesser of two evils, what can you do?" She was sentenced to 20 years in state prison, but she only actually needed to serve 18 months before spending 18 months on house arrest. After credit for time served, she did 7 months in jail and was released to her house arrest and 5 years probation on December 7th, 2022. The New Yorker reports that federal law enforcement data shows women lose their homicide cases 25% more than men do in court, despite the fact that women are more likely to own guns exclusively to protect themselves. The interesting thing is that women surveyed for that article said they don't actually feel like they can defend themselves without being called murderers. Abused women are especially unlikely to be considered rational by authorities when it comes to acting on Stand Your Ground laws.
If you can't use it in her case, I don't know what case you could use it in.
Rachel Louise Snyder is a professor at American University in Washington, D.C., and the author of No Visible Bruises. In her research, she estimates as many as 90% of women convicted of murder killed someone who they accused of domestic violence and sexual assault.
And that's what we expect from our victims. We expect them to be demure. We don't expect them to fight back. We expect them to be, feminine, nice little women who got caught in a bad situation.
In the county where Brittany lives, almost every woman one reporter met had a story about a husband who'd stomped her head or held her at gunpoint, and the police had made them feel like they were at fault. The county sheriff seemed to wave it off as people getting high and doing dumb things. Alabama, coincidentally, has historically been one of the states where a woman is most likely to be killed by a man. They conveniently stopped sending their homicide stats to the FBI in 2011. Brittany says she lied to the 911 dispatcher because she was too scared, embarrassed, and ashamed to admit that she'd been assaulted. Brittany says she really believed Todd was going to kill her and her brother when she shot him. Usually when women are violent, it's defensive because their partners were violent first, while men are more likely to use violence to gain control. The interesting part of this is that even Todd's ex-wife, the one who had her nose broken by him, doubts Brittany's story and thinks she probably just had a rough but willing time with Todd. In the Netflix documentary, State of Alabama versus Brittany Smith, Brittany says, "I want to get my children back. I want them to know that mommy's not a murderer and the mommy defended herself and that you should always defend yourself." The DA in this case said, "Stoking the fires between opposing social media factions, she ought to have gone to prison for the rest of her life versus she was innocent and everything ought to have been dismissed, encourages divisiveness, which we need less of more than ever before." So I hope we can agree that there are some gray areas in this case, that it's not just obviously that Brittany's either a murderer or an angel. I have to admit that when I first started reading about this case, I wasn't sure that I was totally empathetic toward Brittany. Now I'm empathetic, but I'm still questioning. Brittany doesn't exactly inspire trust when she violated her parole several times while awaiting trial, set fire to a mobile home and got charged with arson, and tried to pass off someone else's urine as her own during a drug test after she relapsed. Her mom says she was abused by the justice system, but when your parole officer says you can't go to a trick-or-treating event with your kids and you do it anyway, I question it. I also didn't understand why Brittany's story changed so much and so often, and I didn't understand why she wouldn't get help from the many people who seemed available for it. You could make an argument that Todd had threatened her and she was afraid of him, and I think that's reasonable. But one problem I had is that when her brother came back to the house, he says he accidentally shot once into a cabinet and then laid his gun on the kitchen counter. It doesn't seem like something you'd do if harm was imminent and you needed to protect yourself against someone. The brother says that he was going to try to wrestle Todd out the kitchen door. So I'm still not exactly sure I believe anyone needed to die that night, but I'm trying to trust that Brittany really thought that her brother could die in that headlock, even if she later got some of the details of her story mixed up. I definitely do believe that she was brutally assaulted that night. Brittany has said that Todd had hit on her leading up to that night and she'd rejected him, so my feeling is that this is a case of a drug-addled guy retaliating for his bruised ego. One police dispatcher said that when she didn't flirt back with Todd one time while he was under arrest, he tried to tear her shirt off right there in the station. So I get that Todd had a history of doing very, very bad things, and even his cousin said he believes Brittany. Brittany's mom made a GoFundMe to help her with housing because felons can't stay in government housing where her mom lives. Brittany's mom says Brittany's thankful for all of the support and that even though they weren't paid for the Netflix documentary, they're happy to shed more light on Brittany's story and hopefully keep this from happening to others. Brittany was able to see her kids this past Christmas for the first time in over a year, and just a few days ago, her mom was able to purchase a camper for them to live in. They're hoping to get Brittany's probation transferred to Tennessee so they can leave Alabama. In interviews, I find Brittany and her mom to be lovely people in general, and I really hope the best for them as they try to pick up the pieces of their lives and move on. While Brittany packs her belongings, I'd love to know what you think about this case. Thank you for tuning into my podcast episode. I'm just a true crime fan like you are, and I really appreciate you taking a chance on me. Please subscribe and tell a friend if you like spending this time together. You can also find me on YouTube in the flesh by searching Katie Does Crime.